the unintended consequences of tariffs could be rather large. You can basically lose competitiveness in downstream sectors. And so the ripple effects of these tariffs are likely to be much more complex and dangerous in a world of global value chains.
Welcome to another Vox Talk from the Paris School of Economics, CEPR Policy Forum 2026. I'm Tim Phillips. But Europe didn't start the realignment in world trade, but it can't avoid it. And if it's caught in the middle, accommodating the interests of the US and the responses from China, how does it make good policy? And who wins and loses in Europe from this realignment? Forum keynoter Paul Antras of Harvard University and CPR, and Beata Jaworczyk of the EBRD and Oxford University and CPR as well, are having a discussion this afternoon as part of the forum, but we get a sneak preview of it. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics. Both of you, welcome, Beata.
Thank you.
And welcome, Paul.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Paul, first of all, your work is showing that in trade terms, the world's not necessarily deglobalizing, it's reshuffling. So what is being reshuffled and who's it being reshuffled to?
The world economy is being reshuffled in many ways, but the one thing that I'm going to emphasize today is a very notable shift of Chinese exports from the US, where it had been selling a lot in recent years, to other markets. So obviously, we all know this has been triggered by the US-China trade war. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of discussions about US-China trade, been a lot of discussion about how Chinese goods are making still their way into the US through third markets. There's less academic work on this deflection of Chinese exports onto other markets and the sort of challenges this means for third markets.
And the market we're particularly thinking of, Beata, is Europe. If China's exports are now destined for Europe, is that a threat for Europe or is it a gift to Europe?
The short answer is depends whose perspective you take. The big challenge facing Europe right now is high energy costs. 6 years ago, the cost of natural gas in Europe was the same as in the US. Then, of course, as a result of the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Europe experienced an energy shock. We switched from buying gas supply through pipeline to LNG. And because the supply of LNG globally was limited, that meant that our prices in Europe of natural gas were six times as high as in the US. And then more supply terminals were coming online that lowered that ratio. And of course, we had the second energy shock resulting from the conflict in the Middle East. Now, why am I talking about energy prices, about prices of natural gas? Because price of gas in many countries determines the electricity price. And high electricity prices in Europe are undermining the competitiveness of European energy-intensive industries. Mm-hmm. And we have seen a big drop in output of those industries. And it's not just Germany, it's other advanced countries, but it's also Central Europe, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Slovakia. So what can we do about it? Well, we can speed up the green transition. And that's where China comes in. If we want to speed up green transition, we should take subsidized solar panels or even subsidized wind turbines as a gift from China, because it will help us produce more renewable energy and it will alleviate the high energy costs. But of course, this is not going to be popular among European firms producing wind turbines.
The same deflection that I was mentioning before is, of course, a concern for certain firms that are going to feel higher competitive pressures, both in foreign markets, but also in their domestic markets. But obviously, if these firms are facing higher competition, it's in part because of higher energy prices, but also because of cheaper prices of Chinese firms that are dumping what they cannot sell in the US onto third markets. Those lower prices, obviously, are an opportunity for certain economic agents. They're an opportunity for consumers when it comes to finished products. They're an opportunity for firms when it comes to intermediate inputs.
Yeah, I'm not hearing many people saying that what's happening is a gift from China. I mean, Paul, Europe's reflex, like many countries or blocks, is to protect tariff outsiders and subsidize insiders. Now, you've argued that tariffs can misfire in a world where there are global supply chains. What's your argument?
Now, my take on how to react to this is you take the gains when you have them, right? So if you can buy solar panels more cheaply, you do it. Same with finished products. Now, obviously, there's going to be some producers that are going to suffer the consequences of that. And my view is that tariffs is probably not the way to address this. I mean, more direct compensation, something that helps them ride this shock, is going to be better in the long run. That's generally my sense in terms of what the right optimal policies might be. I think tariffs are even more dangerous when it comes to intermediate inputs, when it comes to putting sand in these wheels of global value chains, where you might feel like you're protecting some economic agents, but the unintended consequences of tariffs could be rather large. You can basically lose competitiveness in downstream sectors. And so the ripple effects of these tariffs are likely to be much more complex and dangerous in a world of global value chains. That's economic theory would tell you that. There's some nice recent work on the auto industry, for instance, by Terry Meyer here, Mark Mellitz, and others, that has shown that actually when you do counterfactuals of protection in models with the auto industry and electric vehicles in particular, I mean, the type of implications of tariffs can be quite bad.
Many Trump administration policies have direct consequences for Europe. Some of them are directly targeted at Europe. In February 2026, we spoke to Beatrice Bader Di Mauro and Ugo Panizza of the Graduate Institute Geneva, President and Vice President of CEPR, about how Europe should respond in our episode, What Should Europe Do About Trump?
Beata, you have been studying the rise in industrial policy for your work with the EBRD. Its report last year was exactly about how industrial policy has been more frequently employed. European policy includes more of what we would call industrial policy. Of course, tariffs are part of that. Is there a version of a European industrial policy that could actually work in this circumstance? Is it all bad?
Well, my take is that industrial policy can deliver, but it's very hard to get it right. And in the context of the rise of China, I think it's instructive to go back to the 1980s and think about the time when everybody was worried about competition from Japanese automakers. Mm-hmm. And that problem was solved in a cooperative manner through voluntary export restrictions introduced by Japan and Japanese FDI into the United States. Right, and we have echoes of that in the Draghi report that is advocating bringing Chinese knowledge in electric vehicle space, mandating knowledge transfers in Europe. The trick with doing this in practice is you want to introduce certain requirements that will facilitate knowledge transfers, but you don't want to put so many requirements on foreign investors so that they have zero incentive to come to Europe. In general, industrial policy works better when you follow some rules. First, articulate the objectives. Why are we doing this? In Europe, we want to electrify transport. We also want to protect employment in the automotive sector, and we have limited appetite for subsidies for electric cars, right? So if you introduce tariffs on imports of electric cars, you are going to slow down electrification of transport. So these two objectives are directly on a collision course, right? So it's very crucial to know why you're doing something. Second, make the policy time-bound. Make the expiration date clear from the beginning and make it the burden of the beneficiaries to prove that it actually works. And I think this is the challenge with many of the current proposals, that they are offering help, subsidies, protection without saying when these will expire. And third, think about cross-industry effects. And that's exactly what Paul was referring to. If you are imposing restrictions on the aluminum sector, restrictions that will benefit producers of aluminum, think about what it will do to car producers for whom this crucial input will be more expensive.
We haven't yet talked about the political effects of this. If we have cheaper Chinese goods because of this realignment coming into Europe, it might not be very popular with competitors of those Chinese firms, but it might be pretty popular with consumers. Who are the politicians going to listen to in that case?
Well, what's your guess? And this is obviously in the field of political economy, this has been extensively studied. And we understand that the gains for consumers could be really large, yet be really small for individual consumers, whereas the costs affecting firms are often quite concentrated, and maybe not as large as the benefits for consumers, but the individual firms facing those costs, obviously, they're going to be very vocal about this. And we've seen this in a variety of guises, and it's well understood there's some sectors that are particularly well organized and sort of lobbying for protection. Think about agricultural sector. Don't give me the subsidies. I'm going to block your highways, create havoc. And then consumers are going to be upset about it and say, just give them whatever they want. So that's a well understood issue that producers, particularly in highly concentrated sectors, tend to get their way. And I don't think that's going to be different in this particular instance.
Beata?
Well, you did not mention workers, right? They are also stakeholders in this equation.
They're also voters.
And they are also often quite vocal. Mm-hmm. Now, in the US, backlash against globalization, against the China shock has been very strong because of limited social safety net. In Europe, you know, we try to take care of workers rather than protect jobs through the social safety net. And that means that we haven't had the same kind of backlash as the US.
Now, Beata, your work also shows an unintended effect of export controls, that they can accelerate innovation in the countries, the industries which are forced to accept those export controls.
In joint work with Maggie Chen and Laura Alfaro, we've been thinking about geopolitical externality. When your companies invest abroad, they transfer knowledge, and this transfer knowledge not only has economic implications, it also helps your rival become more prominent on the geopolitical scene. And that has led countries to restrict flows of knowledge. US restrictions on exports of advanced semiconductors are a case in point. As a result, China, against whom these restrictions were directed, has seen a bigger incentive to innovate. Mm-hmm. So think about DeepSeek. As their access to advanced chips was limited, they invested more into developing better algorithms that can make their models perform well. Or think about Huawei. The lack of access to advanced chips means that they are experimenting with stacking chips or linking a large number of chips together. This type of innovation is not conducted in the West because firms are focusing more on shrinking the size of transistors. So the restrictions on technology flows may create a temporary setback for the country that's targeted, but it could result in greater innovation and potentially even leapfrogging.
There is a phrase in the technology business at the moment, that go companies fearing a DeepSeek moment when they realize that suddenly they've been outcompeted by a competitor that they didn't think was capable of doing it. Does this mean that Europe really doesn't have the choke points when it tries to control the way that trade markets function, Beata?
Well, think about mining companies. Mining companies don't like a situation where there is a scarcity of the mineral they mine, because they know that scarcity on the market and high prices will create powerful incentive to develop technologies that will shift towards other natural resources. And, you know, there is some evidence that restrictions on exports of rare earth have led to this type of innovations. So restricting knowledge flows from Europe will mean that our innovations are less likely to be adopted. They are less likely to lead to European standards becoming global standards. So in the end, I am in doubt whether restricting our knowledge flows will help us.
Paul, the Trump administration has been very clear that it doesn't really respect the WTO's rules-based trade system. If we are moving to a place in which the other global powers don't want that trade system, how big a problem is that for Europe?
I think it could be a problem. And again, it connects with the question you just asked, Beata, which is if we move to trade negotiations that are all based on leverage, not rules, what is Europe's leverage? And I don't have a good answer to that. I'm not saying there isn't, but you know, we've seen leverages. It's not easy to identify. Think about the Iran situation, right? I mean, if we had been asked a couple of months ago just how important the Hormuz situation was and how much leverage that proved to be for Iran, I mean, I think very few of us would have guessed that. So I'm not saying there isn't leverage, but it's not immediate in the sense of like minerals or particular industries. Think about tourism, historical sites and things like that. But it's not very clear that, A, this is a strong enough leverage in terms of restricting tourism into Rome or things like that, or that Paris, right? Or that Europe would be wise for Europe to use it. I do think that the rules-based trade system might not be dead. Part of me hopes that this is, we're going through this phase. I do think that Europe is very committed to doing things the right way, conducting diplomacy the right way in a proper manner. Maybe Europe can play this big role of pointing out that, yes, there were issues with how the WTO was running. Yes, there's issues of how many international agreements were working, diplomacy generally. But we seem to be moved to a system that it seems much more chaotic. So maybe being a voice in reason, being the adult in the room, might be a role that Europe might be able to play. But if we go down this path, again, I'm a little bit worried about where Europe is going to be, the leverage that it's going to have.
Okay, I'm going to be that adult in the room. So I want you to imagine that I'm a European trade minister. Don't look at me like that. I could have happened. It could have happened. What thing, if you were advising me, what thing would you tell me to do and what thing would you tell me to not do, Beata?
Well, protectionist interests and protectionist voices are on the rise in Europe. So I would ask you to do some soul searching on multilateral trading rules. Are they still useful and relevant? And if so, what are you going to do to help them survive?
What should I not do?
Dismiss them as irrelevant and useless immediately.
Okay, Paul?
So I'm going to give you a very academic answer. I would tell them to read my paper. the paper I'm going to talk about. My answer is going to be exactly the same as Beata, which is I want to think that the paper that I'll present this afternoon is offering tools to try to identify specifically which are the vulnerable sectors, in which sectors and in which countries are this Chinese competition going to put more pressure on producers, in which circumstances it's going to be more beneficial to consumers. So that, yes, when producers will come and say, you know, we're suffering, we're not doing well because of this, I'm going to have a backup methodology to try to assess to what extent these concerns are valid or not. And then I would ask the trade minister to collaborate with the finance minister, whoever has access to budgets and so on, to make sure that producers that are legitimately being hurt by all this are offered some sort of compensation for this so that they can ride this shock. What would I not tell them to do? Exactly the same. I would tell them, listen to producers. There may be issues coming up. Just try to parse out which are legitimate versus not. And I would obviously encourage them not to go to Brussels and push for protection. I think that's the wrong approach here.
That's good advice. Let's hope they're listening. I could never have been the finance minister, by the way.
I don't think finance or trade ministers read papers. So I think you need a one-pager, Paul.
They'll read Paul's paper after they've listened to this.
They will, I'm sure. I'm confident.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Beata.
It was a pleasure, Tim.
We we had better mention Paul's research for all you policymakers out there, and of course, the rest of you too. It is called The Remains of the Trade, the US-China Trade War and Its Aftermath. Authors, Paul Anthras and Andrea Presbitero.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next time on Vox Talks Economics, Europe in 2050.